is almost possible to see that elephant in the middle of the circle. And with that great thing as the vehicle, other great things also come into the room. Things like language and the miracle of symbols that carry meaning. Or consider the service learning programs that are flourishing on more and more campuses these days. Programs that place students in community activities related to the field they are studying. In a large political science class at a state university, 3/4 of the students were assigned a normal syllabus, while the remainder were assigned all of that plus a field placement. One might think that the latter students would suffer academically. After all, they had to spend extra time and energy on field assignments and might even have resented that fact. But those students did better academically and became more personally and substantively engaged with the course because the great things they met by being involved with the community made their book work more real. Or consider the way students are now learning by means of digital technology, a remarkable way to hold great things at the center of our attention, if my own experience is any measure. I have long been spellbound by the solar system and its workings, but neither the astronomy classes I took in college nor the books I later read satisfied my hunger to understand. But recently, sitting at my computer, using an astronomy lab on CD-ROM, I have started to digest the fundamentals of that discipline in a deeply fulfilling way. One reason for my accelerated learning is the computer's power to create virtual reality. With it, I can make and manipulate models of the planets, their moons, their relationships, and the play of gravity that allow me to place this immensity at the center of my attention, then walk around it and into it as if it were my home, which in a way I now understand more vividly it is. At the same time, I have immediate access to photographs and technical information to refine my understanding, as well as charts that tell me where to look in the night sky. Using similar technology, students in many classrooms are now able to relate more personally to great things in disciplines ranging from architecture to zoology. It is ironic that objectivism, which seems to put the object of knowledge above all else, fosters in practice a teacher-centered classroom. Objectivism is so obsessed with protecting the purity of knowledge that students are forbidden direct access to the object of study, lest their subjectivity defile it. Whatever they know about it must be mediated through the teacher, who stands in for the object, serves as its mouthpiece, and is the sole focus of the student's attention. At its extreme, this purist approach is represented by the math professor who resisted the movement to reform pedagogy in his discipline with the following claim: "Our primary responsibility as mathematicians is not to students but to mathematics, to preserve, create, and enhance good mathematics, and to protect the subject for future generations. Good students," he claimed, "the ones destined to become mathematicians, will survive any educational system, and those are the ones with whom our future lies." The idea of a student-centered classroom arose from such abuses of the teacher-centered model, but it has encouraged abuses of its own. In a student-centered setting, there is sometimes a tendency toward mindless relativism. One truth for you, another truth for me, and never mind the difference. When students are put at the center of the circle, teachers may yield too much of their leadership. It is difficult to confront ignorance and bias in individuals or the group when students themselves comprise the plumb line. Having seen the possibility of a subject-centered classroom, I now listen anew to students' stories about their great teachers, in which a passion for the subject is a trait so often named, a passion that need not be noisy but can be quietly intense. I always thought that passion made a teacher great because it brought contagious energy into the classroom. But now I realize its deeper function. Passion for the subject propels that subject, not the teacher, into the center of the learning circle. And when a great thing is in their midst, students have direct access to the energy of learning and of life. A subject-centered classroom is not one in which students are ignored. Such a classroom honors one of the most vital needs our students have: to be introduced to a world larger than their own experiences and egos, a world that expands their personal boundaries and enlarges their sense of community. This is why students often describe great teachers as people who bring to life things that the students had never heard of, offering them an encounter with otherness that brings the students to life as well. A subject-centered classroom also honors one of our most vital needs as teachers, to invigorate those connections between our subjects, our students, and our souls that help make us whole again and again. By putting the secret that Frost wrote about at the center of the circle, we remember the passion that brought us into this work in the first place, a remembering that cannot happen when we and our students sit in that circle alone. Teaching from the microcosm. When I remind myself that to teach is to create a space in which the community of truth is practiced, that I need to spend less time filling the space with data and my own thoughts, and more time opening a space where students can have a conversation with the subject and with each other, I often hear an inner voice of dissent. But my field is full of factual information that students must possess before they can continue in the field. This voice urges me to do what I was trained to do, fully occupy the space with my knowledge, even if doing so squeezes my students out. As I listen to this voice, the model of a subject-centered classroom becomes appealing for the wrong reason. I could misuse it as an excuse to fill all the space with the informational demands of the subject itself. When I succumb to that temptation, it is not merely because of my training or because I have an ego that wants to be at center stage. Like many other teachers I know, I fill the space because I have a professional ethic, one that holds me responsible both for my subject's integrity and for my students' need to be prepared for further education or the job market. To quote many faculty who feel driven by it, it is an ethic that requires us to cover the field. This sense of responsibility cannot be faulted, but the conclusion that we draw from it, that we must sacrifice space in order to cover the field, is based on the false premise that space and stuff are mutually exclusive. To teach in the community of truth, we must find some way to transform this apparent contradiction into a paradox, one that honors both the stuff that must be learned and the space that learning requires. We can begin with a simple pedagogical fact. If the aim of a course is to deliver a great deal of information, the worst way to do it is by nonstop lecturing, although lecturing can serve other purposes quite well in ways I will describe later. The human brain is simply not good at retaining armies of facts as they march single file through a lecture laden with information. Facts are far better delivered via texts or electronic formats, where students can do with them what the brain requires. Look at them once, look at them again, and check them once more, then massage them, correlate them, and apply them in brief but frequent installments. When facts about the subject are dumped en masse, students are overwhelmed and their grasp of the facts is fleeting. Knowing this, we might revisit the metaphor of covering the field, which unconsciously portrays teaching as the act of drawing a tarp over a field of grass until no one can see what is under it, and the grass dies and nothing new can grow. That is not a bad description of what happens to students in fact-laden courses. They fail to understand the subject, retaining the information just long enough to pass the test, and they never want to pick up a book on that subject again. How can we reconcile the demands of space and stuff? Some approaches began to emerge for me when I asked myself, what is the optimum use of the brief time my students and I share in the space called the classroom? Rather than use that space to tell my students everything practitioners know about the subject, information they will neither retain nor know how to use, I need to bring them into the circle of practice in that field, into its version of the community of truth. To do so, I can present small but critical samples of the data of the field to help students understand how a practitioner in this field generates data, checks and corrects data, thinks about data, uses and applies data, and shares data with others. That is, I can teach more with less, simultaneously creating space and honoring the stuff in question. Yet how can a small but critical sample of data adequately represent the vastness of any field, of the great things we are trying to understand? The answer comes as we remember that every discipline has a gestalt, an internal logic, a patterned way of relating to the great things at its core. Thus, every discipline is like a hologram, the model mentioned in Chapter 4 that some physicists use to describe the underlying logic of reality itself. A hologram is an ordering of visual data that we regard as remarkable for the way it allows us to see a three-dimensional object on a two-dimensional surface. But a hologram has an even more remarkable trait. Every part of the hologram contains all of the information possessed by the whole. As one physicist describes it, if the film of a rose hologram is cut in half and then illuminated by a laser, each half will still be found to contain the entire image of the rose. If the halves are divided again, each snippet of film will always be found to contain a smaller but intact version of the original image. Take any piece of a hologram, and from it you can reconstruct the whole. Holographic logic was anticipated 2.5 centuries ago by William Blake in A Simple Image from Auguries of Innocence, where he suggests that we can see a world in a grain of sand. Every academic discipline has such grains of sand through which its world can be seen. So why do we keep dumping truckloads of sand on our students, blinding them to the whole, instead of lifting up a grain so they can learn to see for themselves? Why do we keep trying to cover the field when we can honor the stuff of the discipline more profoundly by teaching less of it at a deeper level? Each discipline has an inner logic so profound that every critical piece of it contains the information necessary to reconstruct the whole. If it is illuminated by a laser, a highly organized beam of light, that laser is the act of teaching. This theory may seem difficult to translate into practice, but it is implemented every day in some of our most time-honored pedagogies. Consider the science lab. Here are 30 botany students peering through 30 microscopes at stem sections from the same plant. Alone and together, guided by a teacher, they examine this grain of sand, and in the process they learn the logic of the discipline, its rules of observation and interpretation, as well as some substantive facts. What they discover by examining this microcosm, then another and another and another, can eventually translate into literacy in the discipline at large. By diving deep into particularity, these students are developing an understanding of the whole. No matter what great thing we are studying, there is always an equivalent to the stem section under the microscope. In every great novel, there is a passage that, when deeply understood, reveals how the author develops character, establishes tension, creates dramatic movement. With that understanding, the student can read the rest of the novel more insightfully. In every period of history, there is an event that, when deeply understood, reveals not only how historians do their work, but also illumines the general dynamics of that epoch. In the work of every philosopher, there is a pivotal idea that, when deeply understood, reveals the foundations of his or her system or non-system of thought. By teaching this way, we do not abandon the ethic that drives us to cover the field, we honor it more deeply. Teaching from the microcosm, we exercise responsibility toward both the subject and our students by refusing merely to send data bites down the intellectual food chain, but by helping our students understand where the information comes from and what it means. We honor both the discipline and our students by teaching them how to think like historians or biologists or literary critics, rather than merely how to lip-sync the conclusions others have reached. I want to offer 2 real-life examples of how teaching from the microcosm can be done in fact-laden fields. In the next section, I tell a large story about the reform of medical education. In the section after that, I tell a small story about my own course in methods of social research. With these stories, I hope to show not only that teaching from the microcosm works in the real world, but also that it can work better than our well-meant but misguided attempts to cover the field. The microcosm in medical school. At a large research university where I had spoken about community and education, I was invited to lunch by the dean of the medical school, who said he had a story that might interest me. Several years earlier, he and a few colleagues had become concerned about the kinds of doctors their students were becoming. The compassion that had led many of these students to enter medical school had largely disappeared by the time they completed their studies. They came into the program caring deeply about people and their health, but 4 years later, they tended to treat patients as objects to be repaired if possible and overlooked if not. The dean and his colleagues also worried that too few of their graduates had learned how to learn. They had mastered the aggregation of theory and fact taught in the conventional curriculum, but nothing in that curriculum taught them how to keep current with a fast-flowing stream of knowledge that will look quite different in a few years than it does right now. So the dean and his small band began advocating an alternative approach. To explain its significance, the dean offered me this image of a traditional medical education. For the first 2 years, the students sit in an auditorium while a professor up on the stage, pointer in hand, goes through the bones of a skeleton hanging from a rack. The student's task is to memorize all that information, feed it back on tests, and use it in laboratory settings. Then, at the beginning of the third year, they meet their first live patient, and we wonder why they treat that patient like a skeleton hanging from a rack. To say nothing of the fact that this sort of hand-me-down learning gives students no experience at finding things out for themselves. But objectifying the patient and dumbing down the students were not the only problems that worried the dean and his colleagues. They were also concerned about an academic culture that motivated their students to learn not in order to treat patients, but to best one another in competition, which led to some sad outcomes. Occasionally, a professor would place an assigned journal article on reserve in the library. But when the fourth or fifth student went to read it, someone seeking advantage would have cut it out with a razor. Once again, compassion for the patient had disappeared, for the information in that article might have helped a doctor treat a patient someday. Once again, students failed to learn how to learn in a self-motivating manner and learned only to win at the expense of one another. So the dean and his allies proposed a new approach, originally developed at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. Its key feature is that students, from their first day in medical school, are gathered in small circles around a live patient with a real problem and are asked to diagnose the patient's condition and prescribe a course of treatment. The dean was quick to assure me that there is a mentor in each circle, a teaching physician who makes sure that this band of amateurs does not do the patient harm. But the mentor's job is not to tell the students what the diagnosis or the prescription is. The mentor is there to guide a collective inquiry into the great thing, the patient and the question of illness and health, that has been placed at the center of the student's attention. The dean explained, "On one level, the students sitting in that circle do not know very much. Some of them have no pre-med training at all, since we admit all kinds of majors to medical school these days, and even those with a pre-med background have no real clinical training. But on another level, these students know a lot. As individuals, they know something simply because all of them have been sick and have known people who were sick, so they have experiential clues about illness and health. As a group, they know even more. Here sits a student who has a gift for observation, who is noticing the dullness of the patient's eyes. There sits a student with a gift for intuition, who is picking up information from the patient's body language. And there is a student with a gift for asking questions, who can get more information from the patient in a few minutes than most of us could get in an hour. If you can get all of those people and their perceptions to multiply exponentially in a good group process, it is sometimes possible for a collection of amateurs to come up with solid insights." In this model of medical education, that small circle of students around a patient, that small version of the community of truth, is the hub that turns a larger wheel. From this hub, this living center, students move out to other educational settings for insights not available at the hub, to the library for independent research, to lecture halls for systematic data on various topics, and to seminars, workshops, and labs for practice in the use of particular skills. But wherever they go, they always return to the hub with new facts and theories that help them understand the patient and the problem. Then they go out from the hub again with new questions that focus the knowledge they gather in other venues. The dean and his allies proposed this model, and after considerable debate within the larger faculty, it was narrowly adopted. When the dust settled, the dissenting faculty made two predictions. The good news was that the new pedagogy would surely improve the bedside manner and medical ethics of their graduates. But the bad news was more than enough to overshadow the good. The new pedagogy, the dissenters said, would cause standardized test scores to go down. Nowhere in this curriculum was anyone systematically covering the field and force-feeding students the facts. For all the humanistic merits of the new plan, its failure to take objective knowledge seriously would put both the students and the school in jeopardy, for both of them live and die by test scores. The dean asked if I would care to guess what had happened in the 6 years since the plan had been adopted. I thought I probably knew, because we do not usually take someone to lunch to tell about our failures, but I wanted to hear the story in the dean's own words. The critics were right about the improvements in medical ethics and bedside manner. We have not had an article sliced out of a journal for several years, and we continually get reports from patients about how helpful our students are. However, they were wrong about the objective tests. Not only did the test scores not decline, but they actually started going up. And during the time we have been teaching this way, they have continued slowly to rise. In this approach to medical education, our students not only became more caring, but also seemed to be getting smarter, faster. Why is this the case? The reason I want briefly to examine relates to the power of teaching from the microcosm in the community of truth. The microcosm in this case being the great thing called the patient at the center of the learning circle. That patient represents the reason most students want to be doctors, to help people get well. So from day one of their medical education, students are engaged by this pedagogy at the level of their original motivation, and they are kept engaged at that level for the duration of their training. This is one reason for the heightened ethical behavior these students now display, an ethic that one hopes will travel with them into professional life. The dean's report that articles are no longer being slashed out of journals suggests that behavior becomes more ethical when a great thing, rather than one's ego, is at the center of one's attention. Those articles stay in the journals because these students get regular reminders that they are learning in order to help people get well, not to best the competition. But the consequences of putting a great thing at the center of our attention are not only ethical, but intellectual as well. These students are getting smarter faster. There are at least two reasons for this, and both of them have to do with the pedagogical power of the community of truth. First, the human brain works best with information presented not in the form of isolated data bits, but in patterns of meaningful connection, in a community of data, as it were. Patterning is what happens when students learn their medical facts through a patient's story, for that story offers both internal and external connections. It connects various facts about the patient with each other in a pattern of correlation and interpretation and explanation, and it connects the student with the patient in a pattern of human meaning. The dean made this point with a comment that is faithful to what we know about how the human brain works. 20 years from now, when one of these students is remembering how the kidney functions, he or she is going to remember that information not as a factoid from a textbook, but in the context of Mrs. Smith's story. In other words, the memory will take communal form, the form of reality itself. Second, this community of truth has pedagogical power because it allows students to do their learning together. Though we persist in believing that competition is the best way to motivate people to learn, these students are far more motivated by the fact that their individual learning enables them to contribute to the communal inquiry, or at least not embarrass themselves by letting the group down. Learning together also offers them a chance to look at reality through the eyes of others, instead of forcing them to process everything through their own limited vision. They can check and correct what they see from various vantage points, thus having a chance to come closer to getting it right. It is said that all of us together are smarter than any one of us alone, and perhaps that maxim is more than wishful thinking. The story of this medical school encourages me in the belief that a pedagogy based on the community of truth is not a romantic fantasy, but can be a practical response to some of our most pressing educational needs. The microcosm in social research. My second example of teaching from the microcosm is considerably more modest than the reform of medical education, so it may help bring this approach closer to everyday practice. Methods of Social Research is one of the most mind-numbing courses in the social science curriculum because it is typically taught as an endless flow of information. I taught it that way myself for a few years until my students fell into a coma and I was forced to seek a more life-giving approach. In the university where I was teaching at the time, methods was a required course that typically drew 150 students, so I needed to find a way to simulate the community of truth in a lecture hall, not a cozy seminar room. To illustrate the simulation I attempted, I will focus on a 2-week passage in mid-course. During this time, I wanted my students to learn certain things about the way social phenomena are known, how to form concepts, develop indicators, collect data with those indicators, correlate those data into patterns, and interpret what those patterns might mean. Naming these goals clearly as the 2 weeks got underway helped put some boundaries around a space that would soon contain a creative mess. To put these subjects at the center of our attention, I drew a simple 4-cell statistical table on the board and left it there for the entire 2-week period as the grain of sand that would focus our exploration. With this table at the center of our circle of inquiry, I taught by asking question after question about it. As the process unfolded, I tried to wait out the silences until responses came, to engage students in dialogue with each other, not just with me, and when the discussion became terminally tangled, to sort things out with a lecturette, always followed by a fresh round of questioning and conversation. My hope was to take these students so deep into this microcosm of methodology that they would learn the logic of practice in the field, or at least become intelligent consumers of social research. I do not have enough pages, nor would you have enough patience, to follow every move my students and I made during that 2-week passage. But I can suggest what happened by describing our approach to concept formation. To bring the abstractness of concept formation to earth, I chose to focus our inquiry on race, because it is so obviously a charged issue in our society, and was especially charged at the university where I was teaching at the time. I believed that exploring race as a concept would create the tension necessary to get and hold my students' attention, and so it did. I began the first session by observing that the researchers who produced this table not only named race as a factor they wanted to study, but also apparently found some way to determine the racial classification of the people they interviewed. "Tell me," I asked, "how do you determine what race a person is?" A few students stared at me, astonished by the stupidity of my question, but most of them looked away, for the same reason. I had to work hard inwardly just to hold the space, a space of silence and stupefaction in which I was sorely tempted to forget teaching from the microcosm and revert to lecturing. But I was able to hold out long enough for one student toward the back of the room to raise her hand tentatively. "Yes, please," I said. "Well, you look," she said. "You just look." When one is teaching this way, and the silence has become an agony, any response is welcome. In my relief, it felt as if this student had just discovered the general theory of relativity. I thanked her for her response and then pressed nervously on. "Tell me," I asked, "what do you look for?" Now even more students were convinced that I had lost my mind, but the energy level rose a bit, perhaps because they smelled blood. "Well, you look for color, skin color," said someone closer to the front, with hints of exasperation and amusement. "Thank you," I said. "Now let's look at the faces around this room. There seem to be 10 or 12 skin colors in here, ranging from a deep ebony to a pale white. Does this mean that we have 10 or 12 races in this room? Or does it simply mean that some of you white folks have been spending time in the sun?" On and on the dialogue went, sometimes frustrating, sometimes funny. But step by awkward step, we worked our way toward a fundamental fact about race. To the extent that race is even a valid concept, a question that my students took more seriously after our discussion, It does not come in boxes provided by God or Mother Nature. Race is an undifferentiated continuum of gene frequencies that we break into categories through an act called concept formation. We place markers at various points on that genetic continuum. Cross this one and you are Caucasian, cross that one and you are African, cross another and you are Asian. As our inquiry went on, my students began to understand several important things about the demands of concept formation. The concept called race is an artifact of the way our minds divvy up and simplify an intricate body of information about human beings. The shape of that artifact is not an idle matter. For better and for worse, the way we conceptualize race makes a difference in this world. Because the concept of race makes a difference, socially and scientifically, it is important to know whether there are legitimate rules for divvying up the data. Is concept formation an arbitrary act, guided only by social bias, or are there ways of breaking into that continuum of gene frequencies that are more faithful to the data, and to human beings, than others? Of course there are legitimate rules, and my students were more eager to learn them because through their own engagement with the microcosm and with the issues it posed, they had come into a deeper understanding of the stakes inherent in defining race than any I could have handed them in a lecture. The understanding they achieved went beyond the particularities of race to the underlying dynamics of any concept. Some of those students may use their knowledge to become creators of new concepts. Knowing now, as they do, the norms of discernment that allow one to stake out a pattern of data and lay claim to a new bit of knowledge. Others may become more discerning as both listeners and speakers. They will be unwilling to accept the careless use of other concepts like gender or nationality, now that they know how much depends on the way our minds connect the dots and frame the phenomena of experience. Before I taught from the microcosm, I gave decent lectures on these matters, and my students learned significant things. But when I taught from the microcosm, taking less space for my words and opening more space for my students to get involved with the subject, they learned more and they learned it better. Learned not only some things that social scientists know, but something about doing social science for themselves. Open space and skillful means. No matter how many success stories I collect, from other educators or from my own experience, when I try to teach by creating space in which the community of truth can be practiced, I struggle against the strong currents of my own training. Like most professionals, I was taught to occupy space, not open it. After all, we are the ones who know, so we have an obligation to tell others all about it. Even though I have rejected that nonsensical norm, I still feel guilty when I defy it. A not-so-small voice within me insists that if I am not filling all the available space with my own knowledge, I am not earning my keep. I know doctors who have a similar struggle when they invite patients to collaborate in their own diagnosis and treatment instead of simply telling them what is broken and how medical science can fix it, or has determined that it cannot be fixed. Virtually all professionals have been deformed by the myth that we serve our clients best by taking up all the space with our hard-earned omniscience. Our resistance to opening rather than filling the space is compounded by the fact that if we decide to change the way we practice our craft, it takes time to make the transition, and while we are in transit, we are not very good at what we are doing. En route to a new pedagogy, there will be days when we serve our students poorly, days when our guilt only deepens. To counteract guilt, I need at least two things. A rationale for what I am doing when I open a learning space, which is why I am writing this chapter, and an understanding of the skillful means required to keep such a space open. As long as our only test of professional competence is the ability to fill the space, while creating space means merely to go with the flow, we will never be able to open the classroom to the community of truth. As long as we do not understand that opening a learning space requires more skill and more authority than filling it up, we will lose our battle with guilt and our teaching will default to covering the field. If we want to honor and develop the skills required to create a space for learning, we must name them and make them explicit. Some of these skills are needed even before the class begins, in conceptualizing the course of study, selecting materials, framing assignments and exercises, and blocking out the time. If I do not make these decisions in ways consonant with opening space, the space will disappear before the class begins. I must define the course in a way more engaging than engorging, countering my tendency to inundate students with data, and allowing them instead to encounter the subject, each other, and themselves. I must provide readings with substance that students need to know, but with gaps in which students can think their own thoughts. And because this virtue is most often found in primary texts, I must be well acquainted with the literature of my field. I must create exercises that invite students to probe the unknown, as well as exercises that reveal what they have learned. I must establish a schedule that allows time for the unexpected, even as it makes time to acquire the predictably necessary facts. Preparing a learning space requires at least as much competence as preparing a good lecture, and more than preparing a bad one. But despite the competence required to fulfill this list of musts, I have not yet walked through the classroom door. When that door closes behind me, another set of skills is required to use and protect the space. For example, in the methods course, I relied on the skill called questioning, which sounded easy to me until I tried it. Then I discovered the enormous variety of questions I had to choose among. Some questions close down the space and keep students from thinking. What did the textbook have to say about concepts and indicators in Chapter 4? Other questions open up so much space that they lose students in a trackless wasteland. What is going on in this four-cell table? The questions that help people learn are found somewhere between these extremes. If you had been one of these researchers, how would you have decided what race your subjects were? Of course, the skill of asking questions goes beyond asking the right kinds of questions to asking them in a manner neither threatening nor demeaning, and receiving responses in the same open and inviting way. Every good teacher knows how easy it is to respond with the right words but dismissive nonverbal judgments, and how quickly this will freeze the discussion. When we learn to ask good questions, we discover that yet another competence is needed. The ability to turn a question and answer session between the teacher and individual students into a complex communal dialogue that bounces all around the room. My students will learn much more when I turn their eyes from always looking at me and help them look at one another. I must deflect comments addressed to me and bounce them back to the group, perhaps simply by saying, "What do you all think about the point that Sandra just made?" but preferably by being more subtle. However I do it, this deflecting involves a challenge to my soul. I must learn how to trust that the community has the resources necessary to deal with the issue at hand. I feel that challenge most urgently when a student says something utterly untrue, and everything in me wants to rise up and smite this falsehood with a sword of truth. If I want to encourage the conversation that the community of truth requires, I must learn to ask myself in that crucial instant a simple but demanding question. How quickly do I need to do the smiting? Can it wait 30 seconds? A minute? To the end of the hour? Until the next class? As I consider my options, it becomes clearer that I need not smite immediately. Even with that untruth before us, we, and truth, will survive a few more minutes or hours or days. Then, as I step back from my sense of urgency, it becomes more and more likely that someone else in the group will step forward to challenge what has been said. When that happens, the community of truth comes more fully to life. But if I learn to ask good questions, deflect answers, and connect my students in dialogue, the job is still not done. I must learn the skill of lifting up and reframing what my students are saying so that we will have benchmarks of how far we have come and how far we have to go toward whatever we are trying to learn. The richness of the community of truth lies in the fact that its process is nonlinear. Its tracks lead in diverse directions, sometimes circling back on themselves, sometimes jumping far ahead. In the midst of this creative chaos, the teacher must know when and how to draw a straight line by connecting comments that have been made revealing a trajectory of inquiry that can both confirm what we know and take us somewhere new. To do this, I must listen so attentively to what my students say that I can relate the comment just now made to one made 20 minutes ago. Attentive listening is never an easy task. It consumes psychic energy at a rate that tires and surprises me. But it is made easier when I am holding back my own authoritative impulses. When I suspend, for just a while, my inner chatter about what I am going to say next, I open room within myself to receive the external conversation. Once I have listened and traced the trajectory, I am ready to reframe, to articulate what we have learned in a way that relates it to where we have been and where we are about to go. For example, my students in the methods course came close on their own to the insight that race is a mental construct rather than a biological reality. Yet they never quite made the leap into framing it as an undifferentiated continuum of gene frequencies that we break into categories. My students lacked that language, so it was my task to reframe the scattered pieces of our conversation. But I needed to wait for the moment when my students could experience it as their own, as a way of naming a discovery that they had made for themselves but were not yet able to put into words. With that reframing, we accomplished three important things. We gathered up the elements of our dialogue and gave them coherence. We built a bridge to our next topic. And we did it all in a way that made students full participants in this miniature version of the community of truth. By reconstructing the dynamics of teaching and learning in the community of truth, I remind myself that teaching this way involves much more than going with the flow. I must hone certain skills and learn others as I go to make a space for this kind of education to happen. Community, varieties and obstacles. Engaging students in the dynamics of the community of truth is a principle of sound pedagogy. But the methods I have examined for creating that community in the classroom are neither normative nor exhaustive. The right method to use in replicating the community of truth is one that emerges from the identity and integrity of the teacher. What seems right for me after many years of searching is to sit in a circle with my students, or try to relate to the crowd in a lecture hall as if we were in a circle, and lead an inquiry into the great thing in our midst. But there are other ways to create community in the classroom, and some of them look nothing like the interactive encounter we normally associate with that word. I need only recall the mentor I wrote about in Chapter 1. In his courses on the history of social thought, he lectured nonstop while we sat in rows and took notes. But those classes were not teacher-centered. His lectures put the subject, not himself, at the center of our attention. And we somehow gathered around that subject and interacted with it, though we said hardly a word. How did my mentor manage to stimulate the community of truth and draw his students into it? His lectures did not merely present the data of social theory. They staged the drama of social thought. He did this in part by telling stories from the lives of great thinkers as well as explaining their ideas. We could almost see Karl Marx sitting alone in the British Museum library writing Das Kapital. Through active imagination, we were brought into relationship with the thinker himself and with the personal and social conditions that stimulated his thought. But the drama of my mentor's lectures went further still. He would make a strong Marxist statement, and we would transcribe it in our notebooks as if it were holy writ. Then a puzzled look would pass over his face. He would pause, step to one side, turn, and look back at the space he had just exited, and argue with his own statement from an Hegelian point of view. This was not an artificial device, but a genuine expression of the intellectual drama that continually occupied this teacher's mind and heart. Drama does not mean histrionics, of course, and remembering that fact can help us name a form of community that is palpable and powerful without being overtly interactive or even face-to-face. When I see a good play, I sometimes feel strongly connected to the drama, as if my own life were being portrayed on the stage. But I have no desire to respond aloud to the line just spoken, no urge to run up the aisle, jump onto the stage, and join in the action. Sitting in the audience, I am already on stage in person, connected in an inward and invisible way that we rarely credit as the powerful form of community that it is. With a good drama, I do not need overt interaction to be in community with the characters and their lives. Similarly, when a good lecture places the drama of great things squarely in our midst, it can manifest the community of truth as fully in its own way as that medical school curriculum or my dialogical approach to methods of social research. I used to wonder how my mentor, who was so awkward in his face-to-face relations with students, managed to simulate the community of truth so well. Now I understand. He was continually in community without us. Who needs 20-year-olds from the suburbs when you are hanging out with the likes of Marx, Hegel, Durkheim, Weber, and Troeltsch? Yet this man, though he communed more intimately with the great figures of social thought than with the people close at hand, cared deeply about his students. The passion with which he lectured was not only for his subject, but also for us to know his subject. He wanted us to meet and learn from the constant companions of his intellect and imagination. And he made those introductions in a way that was deeply integral to his own nature. Through this teacher and his lectures, some of us joined a powerful form of community marked by the ability to talk with the dead. This is not a mark of madness, but of an educated person. Learning to speak and listen in that invisible community of history and thought makes one's world immeasurably larger and forever changes one's life. But to some teachers who care about these things, it makes no difference whether we define community as overt interaction or as drama or as inward dialogue. These teachers claim that education will never achieve community in any form as long as teacher-student relations are riddled with inequalities in status and power. Teachers must evaluate and grade the work students do, which sets teachers against students and students against each other. How is community possible when such divisive dynamics are at work? The question assumes that community can happen only where there are no divisions of status and power. But such places do not exist. If community is to emerge, it will have to be in the midst of inequalities that appear whenever two or three are gathered. To argue that grades must be eliminated before community can emerge is to assume a utopian alternative nowhere to be found. It is to give up on community altogether. When authentic community emerges, false differences in power and status disappear, such as those based on gender or race. But real differences remain, and so they should, for they are created by functions that need to be performed if community is to thrive, such as the leadership task of maintaining the boundaries and upholding the standards that define community at its best. Evaluation is one such function in education. The community of truth demands continual discernment. Some observations are accurate and some are not. Some claims of fact are valid and others are not. Some hypotheses are warranted and others are not. When grades are used to make distinctions of this sort, they are simply a replication of the real-world dynamics that this approach to teaching is built on. With this real-world principle in mind, we can invent ways of using grades that emphasize learning rather than judging and collaboration rather than competition, thus enhancing the contributions grades can make to community. For example, I offer students the chance to rewrite a term paper as often as they like before the course ends. I grade each version, commenting on its strengths and weaknesses. When I give a final grade, it is not an average, but the grade given for the last version. In this way, I hope to show students that the intent of evaluation is to offer guidelines for learning rather than terminal judgments. I also give assignments that require students to work together on a project, with the understanding that they will all receive the same grade for the final product, not different grades for the different parts they contributed. Grading represents power, and the question we should ask is not how to get rid of our power, but how to use it toward better ends. I am not suggesting that letter grades are a good form of evaluation. They are a very poor form indeed compared to more nuanced methods like the student portfolio. But grades have been with us for a long time and will be for years to come, So it would be wrong to use them as a cheap excuse for avoiding the challenges of community in the classroom. The real threat to community in the classroom is not power and status differences between teachers and students, but the lack of interdependence that those differences encourage. Students are dependent on teachers for grades. But what are teachers dependent on students for? If we cannot answer that question with something as real to us as grades are to students, community will not happen. When we are not dependent on each other, community cannot exist. The problem is that we who teach have been trained, like most professionals, to work in utter autonomy, a mode that makes us and our destinies largely independent of our students. To put it baldly, we do not need them to succeed. Our superior power and status permit us to work this way, but they do not compel us to work this way. It is possible to teach in a manner that puts part of our fate into the hands of students, as part of their fate is in ours. Such a way of teaching yields not only more community, but also more learning by drawing us more deeply into the community of truth. I can illustrate with a story about a guest lecture I was once invited to give. The professor said that the session ran an hour and a half, and when I responded that I would lecture for only 20 to 30 minutes, then open things up for discussion, she urged me not to do so. "This is a big class," she said, "about 150 students, and they are accustomed to lectures, not discussion. I'm afraid your approach won't work very well." I persisted in my plans, but when the day arrived and I was about halfway into my talk before a sea of impassive faces, I began to think that my host had been right. When I finished talking and asked who wanted to get us started with a comment or a question, nervously violating my own rule of asking questions that are specific and concrete, I wished that I had taken her advice. This felt less and less like a guest appearance and more like a public hanging. Then, as sometimes happens, a student who seemed anxious as I, perhaps because she felt sorry for me, raised her hand and asked the question, and I responded. That exchange led to a couple of other hands being raised and on to more and more exchanges. The energy rose, and after a while, a real conversation emerged, multiple in its levels, but steady in its direction. When it was time to leave, I thanked the students in the class for a fine session. They applauded enthusiastically, and about 20 of them came up front to talk. After 10 minutes, the next class started arriving, so we adjourned to the hallway, where a dozen of us continued talking for another 10 or 15 minutes. It was clear that some real learning had happened for a good number of people. As my host walked me to the parking lot, she said, "That was remarkable. I've never seen this class so animated. I noticed that you used a couple of clever techniques to stimulate conversation." She obviously did not know me very well, or she would not have accused me of technique. But I was curious. "What do you mean?" She said, "Every time a hand went up, no matter how tentatively, you leaned forward, motioned toward the person like this." She made a come on gesture with her hand. "And you said, please. Then no matter what that person said, you smiled and said thank you, like you really meant it." My host seemed to feel that these were strategic moves designed to manipulate the group's emotions, but that is not the case. They were the desperate actions of a dying man. There is a name for those moments when I said please and gestured imploringly. It is called begging. There is a name for those moments when I said thank you for the smallest crumb. It is called gratitude. When you are starving, you beg for help without shame, and you are genuinely grateful for anything anyone offers. I had run out of lecture that morning with an hour left to go, and I needed the help of those students if our encounter was to be worthwhile. When we are willing to abandon our self-protective professional autonomy and make ourselves as dependent on our students as they are on us, we move closer to the interdependence that the community of truth requires. When we can say please because we need our students and thank you because we are genuinely grateful for them, obstacles to community will begin to fall away. Teachers and students will meet at new depths of mutuality and meaning, and learning will happen for everyone in surprising and life-giving ways. Chapter 6. Learning in Community. The Conversation of Colleagues. The best thing for being sad, replied Merlin, is to learn something. That is the only thing that never fails. You may grow old and trembling in your anatomies. You may lie awake at night listening to the disorder of your veins. You may see the world around you devastated by evil lunatics, or know your honor trampled in the sewers of baser minds. There is only one thing for it, then, to learn. Learn why the world wags, and what wags it. That is the only thing which the mind can never exhaust, never alienate, never be tortured by, never fear or distrust, and never dream of regretting. Learning is the thing for you. T.H. White, The Once and Future King. Teaching Behind Closed Doors. When I imagine the community of truth gathered around some great thing, from DNA to the heart of darkness to the French Revolution, I wonder, could teachers gather around the great thing called teaching and learning, and explore its mysteries with the same respect we accord any subject worth knowing? We need to learn how to do so, for such a gathering is one of the few means we have to become better teachers. There are no formulas for good teaching, and the advice of experts has but marginal utility. If we want to grow in our practice, we have two primary places to go: to the inner ground from which good teaching comes, and to the community of fellow teachers from whom we can learn more about ourselves and our craft. If I want to teach well, it is essential that I explore my inner terrain, but I can get lost in there, practicing self-delusion and running in self-serving circles. So I need the guidance that a community of collegial discourse provides, to say nothing of the support such a community can offer to sustain me in the trials of teaching and the cumulative and collective wisdom about this craft that can be found in every faculty worth its salt. Resources that could help us teach better are available from each other, if we could get access to them. But there, of course, is the rub. Academic culture builds barriers between colleagues even higher and wider than those between us and our students. These barriers come partly from the competition that keeps us fragmented by fear, but they also come from the fact that teaching is perhaps the most privatized of all the public professions. Though we teach in front of students, we almost always teach solo, out of collegial sight, as contrasted with surgeons or trial lawyers who work in the presence of others who know their craft well. Lawyers argue cases in front of other lawyers, where gaps in their skill and knowledge are clear for all to see. Surgeons operate under the gaze of specialists who notice if a hand trembles, making malpractice less likely. But teachers can lose sponges or amputate the wrong limb with no witnesses except the victims. When we walk into our workplace, the classroom, we close the door on our colleagues. When we emerge, we rarely talk about what happened or what needs to happen next, for we have no shared experience to talk about. Then, instead of calling this the isolationism it is and trying to overcome it, we claim it as a virtue called academic freedom. My classroom is my castle, and the sovereigns of other fiefdoms are not welcome here. We pay a high price for this privatization. Consider the way teaching is evaluated. When we cannot observe each other's teaching, we get evaluation practices that are distanced, demoralizing, and even disreputable. Lacking first-hand information about each other's work, we allow the artifacts of the student survey to replace the facts that can be known only in person. The normal mode of evaluating teaching is to give students toward the end of the course a standardized questionnaire that reduces this complex craft to 10 or 15 dimensions, measured on a 5-point scale, gives clear and concise instructions, organizes lectures well, establishes objective criteria for grading. Teachers have every right to be demoralized by such a simplistic approach. The nuances of teaching cannot possibly be captured this way. No uniform set of questions will apply with equal force to the many varieties in which good teaching comes. But if we insist on closing the door on our work, how can others evaluate us except by tossing some questionnaires over the transom just before the end of the term? Evaluations of this sort are not simply the result of administrative malfeasance, as faculty sometimes complain. They are the outcome of a faculty culture that offers no alternative. Sadly, the limitations of these evaluations are so cynically accepted, and their outcomes so selectively invoked, that the data are easily used in an institutional shell game. If we want to fire someone who has good teaching evaluations but few public